Well, as we come this evening to take a final look at Paul as an example to believers, we are looking today at Paul's public life. And this evening, we want to consider his boldness, Paul's boldness. Paul, as a Christian, was courageous. No one should doubt the courage of the apostle. And his courage in defense of the truth often led to physical punishment. He suffered physically for his boldness and courage. He was beaten. He was stoned almost to death. He was thrown in jail. All kinds of things were cast upon Paul. It is not as an armchair Christian that Paul tells us to be courageous and to be bold. If Paul never suffered anything and then said, "Well, now I want you to be bold," we might say, "Well, it's all very well for you. You never suffered anything." But when Paul, having suffered so much, says to us, "Now you do the same," well, we cannot object to anything that he tells us. There were occasions when he was, yes, misunderstood by other Christians. There were occasions when he was maligned and slandered by them. And there were occasions, of course, when his enemies were the ungodly who hated him. And yet, no matter what was thrown at him, he remained steadfast and faithful, and courageous, and bold. And he writes to us and says, "I want you to be as bold as I was." Not because I was anything great, but the grace of God fired me up and made me bold and courageous. And I trust that we will be fired up by what we learn to be equally courageous and bold. Firstly, then, his public spiritedness. His public spiritedness. Paul's driving concern was the church. Let's look at 1 Corinthians 11. And we shall read from verse 16. 1 Corinthians 11. "But if any man seem to be contentious, we have no such custom, neither the churches of God. Now in this that I declare unto you, I praise you not, that ye come together not for the better, but for the worse. For first of all, when ye come together in the church, I hear that there be divisions among you, and I partly believe it. For there must be also heresies among you, that they which are approved may be made manifest among you. When ye come together, therefore, into one place, this is not to eat the Lord's supper, for in eating every one taketh before other his own supper, and one is hungry, and another is drunken." So here in 1 Corinthians 11, he is making it clear that his great concern was for the church. He was interested in the state of the church, and that was an ongoing consideration. And when you come to 2 Corinthians 11, let's look at the same section. And not because I have made it that way, but it just so happens that's the way it is. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 16. He says, "I say again, let no man think me a fool. If otherwise, yet as a fool receive me, that I may boast myself a little. That which I speak it not after the Lord, but as it were foolishly, in this confidence of boasting, seeing that many glory after the flesh, I will glory also. For ye suffer fools gladly, seeing ye yourselves are wise. For ye suffer, if a man bring you into bondage, if a man devour you, if a man take you, if a man exalt himself, if a man smite you on the face. I speak as concerning reproach, as though we had been weak. Howbeit, when insoever any is bold, I speak foolishly, I am bold also. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. and labor is more abundant, and strikes above measure, and prisons more frequent, and deaths of the Jews 5 times received I, 40 stripes save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods, once was I stoned, thrice I suffered shipwreck, a night and a day I've been in the deep, and journeyings often, and perils of waters, and perils of robbers, and perils by mine own countrymen, and perils by the heathen, and perils in the city, and perils in the wilderness, and perils in the sea, and perils among false brethren, and so on. Now, why would he do all this? He lived for the cause of Christ. To that end, he lived with danger and experienced danger constantly. And all for the sake of the cause of Christ. In Acts 20, verse 24. But none of these things move me, neither count I my life dear unto myself, so that I might finish my course with joy in the ministry which I received of the Lord Jesus to testify the gospel of the grace of God. We have noted this verse on a previous occasion. I remind you of a couple of things that I said then. A holy courage, a holy content, a holy concern. The gospel must be heard. The gospel must be maintained. And when we look at the apostle and compare our lives in comparison, we might say, how shallow our lives seem to be. We fill it with so many things. But what place does the cause of Christ have? The church have in our lives? I know, I trust we all attend the public means of grace. Well, you've been to the public means of grace on a normal weekly basis. Well, what then? Do you go about your life and say, well, I've been to the means of grace on the Sabbath day, and now I go about all my other business, and I can forget about the cause of Christ. No, says the apostle, we can't ever forget the cause of Christ. Our pursuit of worldly interests, many of them may be lawful. Others pursue worldly honors, worldly praise, worldly positions. Paul says, my pursuit. My pursuit is to see the kingdom of heaven advance in this world. I want to see the gospel known in all other places. If others are greedy and jealous over money and gain and honors and property, Paul was greedy and jealous for the advance of the gospel. Now what he says in Acts 20, in that 24th verse, the grace of God. In other words, as Christians, we have a big vision, not some little narrow vision. In that big vision, we have family, friends, colleagues, unconverted. They must hear the gospel of the grace of God. And then we move outside the district and we look at the entire country in which we live. We've got a big vision. And then we look across the globe. We want the entire world to hear the gospel. That's Paul's public spiritedness. And that's why we are to continue to support the church, be part of it, because we have that public spiritedness. We want to see the church advance. Oh, I know it can be difficult if you're in a congregation and there's maybe half a dozen of you, or a dozen, and you meet every week, and then some folk come, they look around, and they don't see too much going on. Say, I'll move elsewhere. And there's been the experience, I'm sure, of some of you. Some come and they say, well, what have you got for the young people? What have you got for the children? And you might say, well, we have a family worship, if that's any good to you. And we have a catechism class, if that's of any interest to you. And they sort of turn their nose up and they say, well, what about activities? You know, do you have this activity and that activity. You say, well, there's a leisure center if you want to go down there. I say, but this is the church. And the church is not in the business of having some kind of leisure facility. We're in the business of transforming lies and then sending these lies out into the public square so that they will be ambassadors for the kingdom of heaven. That's public spiritedness, isn't it? You see someone, and maybe they've been living a very bad life, and they become alcoholic perhaps, maybe using drugs, and you get alongside them, you talk to them, maybe week after week, and they'll finally say, we want you to come to the worship of God. They say, oh, that's a bit dodgy that. You're trying to get me a Christian. I say, of course I am. But I want you to come and I want you to hear the word of God. I want you to come to worship God. And then they get converted and their lives are changed. What public spiritedness this is. But it takes courage. It takes boldness. And you all have a network of people. A circle of people, you know. Well, that's your circle. Where's the public spiritedness? Remember Philip? He first findeth Nathanael. He said, I'm going to bring you to Christ. We have lost something of that, haven't we? Oh, I know there was a time. I suspect I know why we've lost it. What happened was, if I digress for a moment, if I'm allowed to digress for a moment, the church had all these gospel missions and everybody brought people along. And then they got lazy and they said, well, we'll leave it all to the church. And then they left off talking to people and getting them along. And so eventually over a period of time, the church declined and got smaller. And now we go into the house, we close the door, we pull the curtains. We don't want to see the neighbors. We don't want to see anybody. We don't talk to anybody about the gospel. No, says Paul, the gospel must be heard. So in that network, a circle of friends that you have, share with them the gospel. Witness to them. That's Paul's driving concern. But then second, diligence in doing good. 1 Corinthians 15 and in the verse 10. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 10. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace which was bestowed upon me was not in vain, but I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. Paul reflected his master. What is it that is said of his master? We are told in Acts 10:38, he went about doing good. He went about doing good. And Paul reflected that. He was like his master, Jesus Christ. I labored more abundantly than they all. The pain and the trouble Paul went to in furthering and advancing the gospel, that's all recorded in the book of Acts. That's why we have the book of Acts. If we didn't have the book of Acts, well, we really wouldn't know what had been going on in those early years. But we see the conflicts, we see the hardships, we see the advance, we see the courage, we see the boldness, and how the gospel advances, and the kingdom of heaven advances. And we read about these early believers and the courage that they had, their steadfastness as they sought to advance the gospel. The trouble that Paul took in this matter. Tackling gain, sirs. It has been wonderful just listening and conversations, the discussions that you have with others. And people have this question and another question. And you have to answer these questions. Well, that's what Paul did too, didn't he? There were those who came along and they said, we don't believe a word you have to say. And he answered them. Another comes along and say, well, we have got a theory. And he answered them. And we have to do something like that too. Constantly giving a defense. Giving a reason. He sought to do these people good. Laboring to establish new converts in the faith. Think of that incident in Acts 20. Told in verse 7. He preached until midnight. Now, we have a very hard chairman, and he tells me, well, I've only got so long. Well, here's Paul. He comes along to the place, and he preaches to midnight. And then there was that character, Yutiki. He fell asleep. He fell out the window, three stories down, and he was killed. That was the end of the meeting for a while. Paul went down. He raised him from the dead. And then they went back upstairs, and he talked until daybreak, all night, seeking to do them good, expending himself, striving to ensure that the Lord's people were benefited. And anyone else who came along, he was unconverted. There's one thing we know about Christians. They will always do you good and not harm. Isn't that right? I hope they're all going to say yes. The ungodly will say, these Christians, I hate them, but you see, if I'm in trouble, that's the ones I'll go to, because I know they'll not let me down. I know they'll not do me any harm. They will do me good. Oh, I know they might take you for a ride because they think you're a soft touch. But at the end of the day, we labor to do good, just like Christ did good. Here were those who were sick, and he did them good. The church doesn't need these charitable institutions. I'll not get into that. But we don't need all these charitable institutions. The world just needs us. We'll do the good. We know how to do these things right, because that's part and parcel of our service. And when they see our good works, they will glorify our Father in heaven. Isn't that what we want? We want to have God glorified on earth. And one of the little ways that we can do it, like Paul doing good. Then thirdly, exercising skill in handling others. Exercising skill in handling others. 2 Corinthians 12, verse 16. May seem a strange statement that Paul makes. He says in verse 15, and I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. But be it so, I did not burden you. Nevertheless, being crafty, I caught you with guile. We know that men and women of the world, they're very clever. They use skill, craft, dexterity in pursuit of their goals. Apostle Paul says, I have no problem whatsoever in using skill in advancing the gospel. Consider for a moment the enormous activities to promote worldly pursuits. You think of our neighbours, they all get together, for example, maybe they're going to get a park for the children. So they all get together and they all spend time discussing and say, now this is what we want, and this is what we're going to do. We're going to lobby these people, we're going to write here, and we're going to do this, and we're going to protest and whatever else they get up to, all to try and get, maybe say, this play park. And they use all kinds of clever devices to try and get the goal. When was the last time Christians got together in a neighborhood, maybe just a couple of families, and discussed, how can we bring the gospel to our neighbors? How can we achieve this? Maybe there are no Christian neighbors, it's just you. When was the last time as a family we got together and we said, well, we've got these neighbors, we've got children next door on one side, children next door on the other side. Maybe we should go and talk to the parents, and if we've got a garage, maybe we could maybe throw all the junk out of the garage, close the door and open the side door and see if we can bring them into the garage, and maybe we could try and do something. Teach these children, and maybe eventually we can try and get them along and their parents to the worship of God. But you think of all the energy that everybody puts into advancing worldly events and causes and goals. And maybe perhaps sometimes we get just a little blasé about it all. We go to our church, that's it. Leave it up to the minister. He preaches, that's fine. We've heard it, now we'll go and get on with other things. Well, perhaps we need to take a leaf out of the apostle's book, literally out of this book and this letter to the Corinthians. He used skill in handling other people. I know those of us who were born and reared in a farm, we don't know much about the diplomacy. You don't need diplomacy on a farm. You get the cows, you get a stick, you drive them into the bar, you get the milk, you kick them back out. So we haven't learned diplomacy, but that's no excuse for the rest of you to be diplomatic. Use some skill in handling other people. How wise are we in promoting spiritual things in comparison to the wisdom the world has and promoting worldly interests? We need to be reminded of the words of the prophet Jeremiah, Jeremiah 4. And he sets out for us in verse 22 a statement that we should, if you want to mark your margin, feel free. For my people is foolish. They have not known me. They are sottish children. They have none understanding. They are wise to do evil. But to do good, they have no knowledge. My people. That's a sad comment, isn't it? If we want to learn a trade, we will get the books out. We'll go to classes. We can be wise to do so many things. God says, my people is foolish. To do good, they have no knowledge. Apostle Paul says in Romans 16 and in the verse 19. Romans 16, verse 19. Second part, but yet I would have you wise unto that which is good and simple concerning evil. Wise unto that which is good. Exercising skill in handling others. In other words, consider the person you're going to talk to. Take a second to think about it. Try and learn something about them. And then try and bring an appropriate comment to them. Be skillful. Be careful. Oh, I know sometimes we're like a bull in a china shop. We really want to take them by the throat and say, can you not see? We forget that once we didn't see. And someone exercised a bit of skill just to explain to us and to teach us. Exercising skill in handling others. Then fourthly, self-denial in lawful things. Self-denial in lawful things. 1 Corinthians 8. And in the verse 13. Wherefore, if meat make my brother to offend, I will eat no flesh while the world standeth, lest I make my brother to offend. Am I not an apostle? Am I not free? Chapter 9. Have I not seen Jesus Christ our Lord? Are not ye my work in the Lord? If I be not an apostle unto others, yet doubtless I am to you, for the seal of my apostleship are ye in the Lord. My answer to them that do examine me is this: have we not power to eat and to drink? Have we not power to lead about a sister, a wife, as well as other apostles, and as the brethren of the Lord and Cephas? Or I only and Barnabas, have not we power to forbear working? And so on. Paul was willing in points and in circumstances, if they were right, to deny himself even something lawful just to advance the truth, to advance the gospel, to advance Christ's kingdom. He learned the lesson taught by Christ. Remember how Christ speaking to the disciples, speaking to those who came to hear him. We turn to Mark chapter 8 and verse 34 to 8. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life for my sake and the gospel's, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for a soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Paul learned that first lesson of Christ, self-denial. That's what he's telling us in 1 Corinthians 8 and the first part of chapter 9. There are circumstances when I will have to forego a certain thing. I will forego something in order that I will not offend the Lord's people. In other words, he had a care for other people. And even though the thing is lawful, well, I would rather not do it than offend. I know sometimes we might say, well, I want to do it. I see no harm in it. And if they have a problem with that, well, nothing I can do about that. That wasn't how Paul thought. His courage extended to saying, well, if this circumstance requires self-denial, then that's what I do. On this occasion, I will not, in order that my brother is not offended. And fifthly, readiness to suffer. A readiness to suffer. Philippians 3, verse 8. Yea, doubtless, and I count all things but loss for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus my Lord, for whom I have suffered the loss of all things. A willingness to suffer. I know that some of you have experienced this. Some of you will experience perhaps even more. But we must be willing. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 4 to 10. But in all things approving ourselves as the ministers of God, in much patience, in afflictions, in necessities, in distresses, in stripes, and imprisonments, and tumults, and labors, and watchings, and fastings. That's a lot of suffering, isn't it? As dying, as chastened, as sorrowful, as having nothing, he was willing to suffer. Paul calls his sufferings a series of deaths. 2 Corinthians 4, verses 9 to 11. It was a series of deaths. C.H. Spurgeon once said, you know, about this life, I don't know whether to describe it as a living death or a dying life. I'm alive, but I'm dying. What was it? It was said of another, he preached as sure as though he would never preach again, a dying man to dying men and women. We're all going to die. Yes, I know we all know it. We don't like to be reminded of it, but we're all going to die. Well, to advance the kingdom of God, we must be willing to suffer. So Paul says, I die daily. All he suffered was for the sake of God's people. He tells us that. I endure all things for the elect's sake, that they may also obtain salvation. To see sinners brought to faith, I endure all things. I suffer. But then sixthly and finally, standing up for what was right. We've noted all these other points, but we must come to this climactic point, so to speak. Standing up for what is right. Standing up for truth. And that is not always an easy thing. And yet we must do it. Acts 16, reading from verse 35. And when it was day, the magistrate sent the sergeant, saying, "Let those men go." And the keeper of the prison told this saying to Paul, "The magistrates have sent to let you go. Now therefore depart and go in peace." But Paul said unto them, "They have beaten us openly, uncondemned, being Romans, and have cast us into prison. And now do they thrust us out privily? Nay, verily. But let them come themselves and fetch us out." And the sergeants told these words unto the magistrates, and they feared when they heard that they were Romans. And they came and besought them and brought them out and desired them to depart out of the city. There are times when things are done wrongly, we as Christians have to take a stand and say that is wrong. It's just plain wrong. Here's why it's wrong. Here's what is right. And this is what you must do. And everything that had happened to him was unlawful. It was plain wrong. And Paul was not prepared to simply walk out the back door of the prison, so to speak, and go away. He was determined and standing for truth to confront them with what they had done wrong. And there are times that we must do that. That's courage. That's boldness. We just have to do it. And it not only applies within the realm of the state, sometimes it even applies in the church. Galatians 2, verse 11. "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to the face, because he was to be blamed." Verse 14, "But when I saw that they walked not uprightly, according to the truth of the gospel, I said unto Peter, before them all, if thou, being a Jew, livest after the manner of Gentiles, and not as do the Jews, why compellest thou the Gentiles to live as do the Jews?" In the state, in society, we sometimes have to take a stand for what is right, for truth. Sometimes in the church, we have to do the same. Something is done wrongly. Of course, we will always do it Christianly. Won't we? We will strive even to be biblical in what we do. Think of Thomas Boston. Boston, he stood alone in the midst of the entire General Assembly. And he protested because there was one man who was teaching what was wrong. And though everybody was enamored with this particular gentleman who was wrong, Boston saw clearly the issues and he protested on the floor of the General Assembly. He was a hero. He's still a hero, I trust. But he had to stand and say, to all these elders, you have got it wrong. He did it as a gentleman. But he was firm. He was bold. He was courageous. And if you know the history of the seceders, denomination that has long since passed in the history, being united with others, there were men, a group of them took a stand. Boston was one of them. The Erskines, of course, those two brothers who were giants. And they protested against the whole issue of patronage. And they were all deposed from the ministry. Well, that's what happened. But they took a stand. They said, we must do what is right. And they were courageous to take a stand. Friends, we must take a stand. Well, I'm not saying we're going to become guerrilla fighters. I'm not saying we're going to be disturbers of the peace of the church. We're not to do that. But we live in a very strange age. Truth and doctrine and honesty, it's all out the window. Everything's all vague. We have this phrase, at least where I come from, it became a very important phrase in politics, studied ambiguity. In other words, you could have a statement that means different things to different people. So that everybody could say, oh, well, you see, I've got my way. Well, they haven't got their way because it doesn't say it. Studied ambiguity. And there are times we have to stand up and say, well, I have read this piece of paper. I've read every word. I've read every sentence. This is my understanding of it. And if it says A, B, and C, I must protest. It is wrong. The Apostle Paul was courageous. Remember that prophet Micaiah in the Old Testament? He were two kings, Ahab and Jehoshaphat. And Ahab thought he was a clever man. And Jehoshaphat said, well, we need to inquire of the prophet of the Lord. And Micaiah was sent for. And of course Ahab said, see that man, all he's got is bad news for me. I hate that man. Jehoshaphat said, well, let's bring him in. So he came in and brought him in. And all the courtiers were all, yes, men, oh, this is going to be a great battle. You're going to win and all the honors are going to come to you, etc. And Micaiah came in and said, oh yes, you're going to go to battle, you're all going to win, and it's going to be a great thing. And he said, see, he's always telling me bad things. And then Micaiah said, now I'll tell you what God says. And it cost him to say what God said. He wasn't a yes man. You and I are not simply to be rubber stamping everything. Think about things. We need to take a stand. This age requires heroes, I think. You are to be the heroes. You're to be the ones who are to take a stand in society and even in the church if necessary. It's a time for heroes. Men and women, to be heroes, to be courageous, to be bold for the kingdom of heaven and for the glory of Christ. Well, let me finish with some points to ponder. Firstly, have an honest appraisal of what you really live for. I want us all to ask, what do I really live for? Well, I'm not saying what we say we live for, but inside in our own hearts, what do we really live for? What really is the priority? And then secondly, has self-indulgence replaced self-denial? Our forefathers thought everything they did was right, but they certainly left a significant legacy for each generation. But the Puritans, even though there were so few of them at the time, but you know, when they managed to gain the ear and the voice of the nation, and they got into Parliament, they had what they called fast days. They called the nation to fasting, and they fasted. And then they assembled both houses, and they appointed a minister to come and preach to them. Must have been absolutely glorious. You can read their sermons, by the way. They've been printed in 22 volumes. If you want to buy 22 volumes of fast-paced sermons, I commend them to you. But you know, fasting, a day of prayer and fasting. They were concerned about the nation. They were concerned about the church. They were concerned about business and about politics and about the state of God's people and the existence of ungodly people. A whole day given to prayer and fasting. They took it serious. If the church of today was to call us all to day of prayer and fasting, how would you feel about that? For me, it'd be no chocolate or chocolate cake. But if they were called to do it, would we be happy to do it? A Brackel, volume 4 of his works, or volume 2 of his works, deals with this matter of fasting. And he says, fasting means we starve because we're taking something serious. And we're not going to feed that hunger. We're going to let that hunger remain. We're going to cry on to God. Have we become flabby? Self-indulgent. Third, when did we take a stand for righteousness? Some of you have stood and are standing and are paying the price. I trust that when you learn of this, you will write your name down. I have to do that. That's such a bad memory. And say, I'm going to pray for that person. They're taking a stand. I want to support them. And I want them to know we are behind them. 110%. Are we taking a stand? When did we take a stand? How did we take a stand? And fourthly, what good are we? What good are we? Do we do good? Are we any good? Are we excellent at every occupation? There was a time the novels that children read were written by Christians. There was a time books on architecture were written by Christians because they were excellent in their business. And every trade and every activity, Christians who excelled at that task, they produced manuals. They were good. What good are we? Oh, I trust that whatever you're at, you are the best. And when anyone wants advice, they are going to come to you. Because they say, well, you've got to ask that Christian, because they know everything about that particular job. And finally, do we seriously put the salvation of perishing sinners before many other things? Do we? Do we put seriously the salvation of perishing sinners before many other things? Paul did. He strove. He labored night and day. Now that doesn't mean you have to cross the globe. They live beside us, don't they? They're our relatives. We live with them, we work with them, we shop with them, we go to the clinic with them. They're all around us. You know, if you sit on a park bench some sunny afternoon and watch everybody go by, do you ask yourself, I wonder how many of those people who pass me by are walking towards heaven? It's a humbling thought, isn't it? Many people we talk to, how many people we see, I wonder how many of them have heard the gospel. Maybe they don't know a Christian. Maybe the only Christian they'll ever meet is you and I. Will we be silent forever? Will we let them pass us by? I think I dread the thought that on the day of judgment, of meeting men and women, and they'll say, I live beside you, and you never once told me. You never spoke to me about the gospel. You talked to me about my garden, how lovely it was. You asked me about my health, but you never said to me, even though I would have hated you, you never said to me, are you a Christian? It's a dreadful thought, isn't it? What did Rutherford say in one of his letters? That if he met those from Anwath in heaven, my heaven would be two heavens. It's a solemn challenge, isn't it? Oh, to be bold. Oh, to be courageous in this world in which we live. Amen.